You're listening to Greater LA from KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hi, I'm Steve Chiotakis. This forklift is moving one of the hundreds of boxes of clothing piled high in this warehouse in Commerce. It's about a mile east of the Citadel Outlets. Now, some of these clothes are tattered and worn out. Others haven't been used at all. All of the clothes have one thing in common. They've been brought here with the hope of diverting them from a landfill.
Corporations are more sensitive to the idea now that, like, there is no away when you throw something away. Like, it's actually going somewhere.
That's CEO Chris Zwicky. He heads up this new wing of Homeboy Industries. You know the company that trains and employs the formerly incarcerated? Well, this new venture is called Homeboy Threads. And the whole idea is to sort through and find new life for old or unsold clothes.
What's used, what could be resold, what needs to be repaired, or what's completely beyond salvage and needs to be recycled.
You already know about recycling glass bottles and paper. Most clothing can be recycled too. And here's a company that just started figuring out how. KCRW's Kaylee Wells has the story.
Homeboy's Chris Zwicky is standing at the front of a giant garage door. This is where trucks of clothes arrive to drop off their loads.
The first thing that we're going to do is we're going to take it in, we're going to open it up and kind of go through a two-stage grading and sorting process.
Stage one, figure out what clothes are in good enough condition to be resold or repaired. Stage two is figuring out what can be recycled into something new. Maybe it can get made into a new piece of clothing.
So someone who's going to process pure cotton or 95% cotton or a mixed blend or, you know, a chemical recycler that might process 100% polyester and make a new thread out of that.
Or even if it's completely tattered, there's a purpose for that too.
You know, mixed material might be shredded up and used for fill or insulation or things like that.
Now, this isn't a place where you as a consumer can bring your old clothes. These trucks are filled with company inventory, whether that's last season's clothes that didn't sell, rolls of fabric that didn't get used, or yes, worn materials that customers brought back to the store. Homeboy can profit in a few ways. They can just sort the clothes for a company, or they can fix the clothes or create new ones and sell them, or they can sell the raw materials, all the while rehabilitating and training formerly gang-affiliated and incarcerated people.
I learned about keeping things out of the landfill. I didn't know all this stuff went to the landfill, so it's interesting. I'm learning about...
Chanalisa Seda started as a trainee with Homeboy a year and a half ago.
How it starts is you're at Homeboy's for like 3 months, and then you need to enroll in a business. And they give you the options, which is electronics, the cafe, bakery, diner, and such, and now we have apparel.
So she trained and became the first full-time employee here. Now she supervises the next cohort of trainees and teaches them what she's learned.
I learned the forklift. I learned how to input weights and data entry into the computers. I learned different fibers, like you can feel it and you can be like, okay, this is that. I learned how to sell things online on e-com. You know, I've never in my life thought I would know how to do any of that stuff.
Some of the clothes that Seda is sorting and transporting around the warehouse belong to the clothing company Guess. Nikolai Marciano is their director of brand partnerships and has worked with Homeboy for more than a year as a sort of pilot project before it officially launched last month.
So initially we started the pilot with store returns, damages, a regular product. And, you know, we were then able to also incorporate to the consumer in April 2022 by allowing them to recycle their own apparel at our U.S. stores, which, you know, these goods are then sent to Homeboy for sorting and reuse.
Marciano says that their customers can bring unwanted clothes back to the store, the customer gets money off their next purchase, and Homeboy gets material to repair, recreate something new, or recycle.
Since the launch of our pilot program in December 2021, Homeboy has received over 200,000 pounds worth of garments to avoid ending up in landfills.
And that's just one clothing store, so there's no shortage of material to work with. Textiles are California's fastest-growing landfill waste. U.S. consumers are tossing about 81 pounds of clothes every year. That's because, on average, we're buying a new piece of clothing every 5 or 6 days, about 5 times as much as we were buying 40 years ago. Plus, there's the store returns and damaged product that doesn't even make it onto Guess's store floor. But Zwicky says he's seeing more consumers and companies who want to know where their unsellable clothes are ending up.
the mysterious black box that they used to work with in terms of maybe just selling a container of it bulk to somebody who takes it overseas and who knows what happens to it, kind of isn't acceptable for them or their customers anymore.
And Homeboy Threads is coming online just in time. California politicians just introduced a bill this year called the Responsible Textile Recovery Act of 2023, which would require producers to figure out how to collect and recycle reusable clothes and textiles, which means there could be a spike in demand for authorized collectors to do all that sorting and repair for companies.
That's a gap in the market that we've seen and that we're filling kind of with our workforce development mission.
It's a gap that Homeboy is uniquely positioned to fill because this apparel business is part of a larger nonprofit that mostly relies on donations to fulfill its mission.
We're here to create jobs, and there's a lot of kind of manual work that goes into what we do. We also need to do that efficiently so that our services are affordable for our customers and, you know, all of that.
Homeboy Threads just moved into their warehouse a couple weeks ago, and the plan is to process thousands of tons of clothes and fabric every month. They're filling a major need with less than 15% of discarded clothes getting recycled. There's a few reasons for that. Clothes are tough to recycle. Even a completely cotton shirt might have labels or embroidery or threads or buttons and zippers. Recycling all that requires sorting and separating. It requires manual labor from a skilled workforce, which is a lot more expensive than throwing it in the landfill.
You're using fairly expensive labor inputs to improve the rewearability, reusability, resellability of a garment. So you have to be strategic about when that makes sense. And that's something that a lot of businesses are trying to design out of their process. Mm-hmm. But for us, that's a perfect job creation opportunity for our workforce.
Marciano with guests says the best thing consumers can do is buy quality clothes that last longer. The idea being the only thing better than diverting waste destined for landfills is to create less of it in the first place. For KCRW, I'm Kaylee Wells.
Coming up, a new documentary looks at a changing Venice, the housing crisis and homelessness there. That's yours after this short break.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Venice, California, in our own backyard, is known for the boardwalk, the beaches, and laid-back surfer lifestyle. But it's also a flashpoint in the local and national conversations about housing and homelessness and gentrification. Venice used to be pretty affordable, and it was home to a diverse range of artists and outsiders and a large black community. But the median home price these days is around $2 million, pricing a lot of folks right out of the neighborhood. Meanwhile, homeless encampments, dots, beaches and parks and alleyways, a stark display of income inequality. Residents, politicians, activists, and unhoused folks scramble for solutions with a lot of finger-pointing.
Venice, where art meets eviction.
Venice, it is the most extreme income inequality in all neighborhoods across the city. We're in a crisis.
The Venice art scene today is brutal. People are getting gentrified out of their spaces.
The surf shops, everything's changing.
In the span of 2 or 3 years, Venice encountered 2 decades worth of gentrification. It was like an explosion.
60,000 people are now homeless in LA County.
The splitting of the haves and the have-nots right in front of you.
Where will they sleep? They'll end up like the 918 people who passed away on the streets of Los Angeles last year.
That's from a documentary titled Unzipped, An Autopsy of American Inequality, which focuses on the human stories and how they reflect similar situations across the country. The film is on a limited run this week in Santa Monica at the Lemley on 2nd Street, and director Colin Cade Gray joins us right now. Colin, welcome to you.
So great to be here. Thanks for having us, Steve.
Why Venice? Why'd you decide to set the film there, considering, you know, housing affordability and homelessness are all over the place?
Yeah, it's a great question. And, you know, initially we had this idea of investigating income inequality through a zip code structure. And the original thought was we were going to go to multiple zip codes around the country and really try to humanize all the abstract statistics and divisive sort of rhetoric around housing and homelessness, the symptom of the affordable housing crisis. And then the more we thought about it, we were like, what if we could find one zip code that had fast rising home sales prices, vanishing affordable housing, rising homelessness? And then it struck us, my goodness, our backyard, Venice, California, 90291, it really is a flashpoint and one of the sort of concentrated areas that this issue is manifesting in. And so we suddenly decided to use this local lens, one community and several families, to sort of investigate this story for this national issue.
You live here in LA, right?
Yes, I've lived in Venice for almost 20 years, and it's changed a lot.
You said statistics, and so I want to talk about one statistic in the film that stuck out to me, that 1 in 40 Venice residents are homeless. More than 1,000 people sleep on the streets there. More recent, you know, the L.A. Homeless Services Authority, LASA, estimates similar numbers. Some people think the numbers may actually be higher. How has the situation evolved since you've been in Venice and then since you started working on the film?
It's a great question, and it's obviously such a complex issue and a very divisive issue in communities everywhere. But since we started filming, we launched in 2018. At that point, you're right, 1 in 40 residents in Venice were homeless. And it is very difficult to, you know, accurately count and get the numbers right. But in the course of filming over 2 years, we saw it, and anecdotally and also the numbers from LASA indicate that the numbers went up dramatically during that 2 to 3 year period. And I think the statistic that probably sets me, you know, back in my tracks every time is that while we were filming, over 5,000 Los Angelenos died on the streets of LA. The average is 3 people die every day on the streets of LA because of homelessness. And it's again such a complex issue, but I just think it's unconscionable that in the wealthiest country in the world, American citizens are dying every day on our streets because of a lack of shelter.
It's a complex issue. It's heartbreaking. It's a heartbreaking issue because you can't, I mean, anywhere you go in LA, you really can't not see it. It's right in front of you. It's on the side of the road. It's in underpasses. And it's heartbreaking. It's awful to see. These are human beings, obviously. You follow several families, Colin, with children experiencing homelessness. Tell us a little bit about Deshaun and Nicole. What was their situation?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was the thing, is that we really wanted to center the film in the lived experiences of people actually struggling across the housing divide in this one community. And we found Nicole and Deshaun when we started filming in the fall of 2018. We'd been looking for several months to find a few of these families to profile. And it's, you know, allowing you to into their lives to document their journey is a big ask, and it's especially difficult when they're experiencing really challenging times. Nicole and Deshaun had been living on the streets 62 consecutive days without shelter when we first started documenting them, and they were very brave to allow us into their lives, and we followed them for over 2 years. But the interesting thing is that they actually, I would say, are almost one of the hopeful parts of the film because of the intervention of incredible frontline services organizations like St. Joseph Center and Safe Place for Youth, which are based here in Venice. They go from the street to a temporary motel, and without giving away the entire ending of the film, they find stability.
Does the fact that, because you're becoming really connected with people that you're interviewing, does that affect the way you do it and how you talk to the subjects of your film?
you get very attached to the people that you're journeying with and documenting. And so we were going into homeless encampments. We were documenting Nicole and Deshaun and their journey. And yeah, it's such a disconnect, because then we would say goodbye at the end of the day and come back to our comfortable home. And they're still there on the street in the middle of these rainstorms, in the middle of, you know, this extreme wealth that surrounds them. There's this abject poverty and misery.
Well, part of the complexity for sure, and, you know, there's no debate about this, that home values in Venice have increased so much, tenfold over the last quarter century, and rents have risen dramatically as well. I want to play another piece from your film.
When Google and Snapchat and other technology companies came, they forced the housing prices sky high.
In Venice, many of the folks that were renting here, because our tech companies were bringing in people, simply said, it's time to sell this because, man, I can finally make millions of dollars for this little 1,000 square foot cottage.
Kamikaze capitalism. It's just disgraceful, and that's why Abbot Kinney Boulevard has been turned into something douchier than Rodeo.
And you know, that point being made about Abbot Kinney, if you want to see the change that's happened in Venice, right,
yeah,
from, say, 15, 20 years ago to today, and I've seen it with my own eyes, is Abbot Kinney, the change in Abbot Kinney, the shops that have gone along Abbot Kinney, because those weren't there so many years ago. And you see the money, right? You see the influence of the tech companies. So how much has Silicon Beach been a part of all this?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think there's all sorts of contributing factors. But I think that's certainly one of them. I don't think you can just say it's the tech companies, but I think there's a bigger issue that's playing out in Venice and in other zip codes around the country. And I think that what we're seeing is, and you mentioned the cost of housing, both renting and owning, and it's just sort of outrageous, I'd say, that in the communities that people who contribute to that thriving community, whether they're teachers, firemen, nurses, service workers, they can't even afford to rent or buy in the communities where they work. And we're seeing this all around America. And I think that it's a really complex and you know, challenging issue, because people who contribute to making our communities thrive should be able to rent and buy in those areas, but they simply can't anymore. And in Venice is really the face of that, because like you said, you know, home prices have doubled, tripled in the last decade. And it's pricing out the people who have made Venice this rich, cultural, diverse area. So whether they're artists, who we always say are often the vanguard, then the victims of the gentrification tsunami, or the historically diverse Black and Latino community that lived in and thrived in Venice for decades, they're increasingly priced out. And so I think, again, we have to ask ourselves, you know, what is the cost of that? Why do diverse communities matter? And what can we do to ensure that we protect, you know, diversity in our communities?
Protecting diversity, of course. And the people who actually live in Venice, right, who make a home there, who raise families there, who have businesses there. You speak to a number of residents who live in Venice who are fed up with homelessness, with encampments around their neighborhood. And I want to play a clip of the president of the Venice Stakeholders Association, a guy named Mark Rajovic, talking about the housing crisis.
There is a moral imperative to house our citizens. I don't believe it means that you have to give everyone a $500,000 one-bedroom unit on the beach in Venice. The city is building the wrong product.
How did you grapple, Colin, with the arguments from housed residents who feel, you know, they feel unsafe, is what they say, in their own neighborhood, and they argue that Venice shouldn't have to uniquely shoulder this responsibility?
It's a really critical question and issue, and that's why we wanted to make sure we gave space in the film to hear from residents who were beyond frustrated, who were fearful. Anecdotally, you know, we in our house, and there's an alley behind our house, And there were homeless people in our alley. And there were a couple times where I'd go in the backyard and found syringes against my daughter's swing set. So I understand the fear and I understand the frustration. But I think where I come from it is that these are fellow American citizens and human beings first. And so demonizing them and sweeping them out of our communities when we don't have enough shelter beds or permanent supportive housing for them, I just don't think is the answer. But at the same time, you need to acknowledge the deep-set anger and frustration at how intractable the crisis seems. And so that's why it was important to hear from Mark and other people in the community. But I think it was actually quite sobering for me seeing that in an ostensibly progressive community like Venice, there was such vitriol and opposition to, you know, common sense housing solutions. Now, this is the huge irony is like bond measure Triple H was LA taxpayers saying, hey, you know, this is a real crisis. We need to raise more funds. And $1 billion was raised so we can build more shelters and more housing. And the minute the city said, well, now we're going to start building these shelters in every district, people lost their minds. I mean, it wasn't unique to Venice. There was huge opposition to the shelters that were being built. But I think you have to build in the places where people have need. And I think, you know, Mark felt they were building the wrong product. It was too costly. I think there's certainly arguments that, hey, how can we be more efficient? How can we streamline? But I think just an outright opposition to building or to providing shelters is really divisive and exclusionary fundamentally. So I think we've got to find new ways to, you know, and there's so many different possible solutions out there. But it was eye-opening, Steve, seeing how much opposition there was and how much anger there was in the community towards these shelters.
What do you say to the fact, Colin, that some of the folks that you interviewed aren't even in this realm anymore? Eric Garcetti, you know, termed out of office, no longer mayor. Mike Bonin didn't seek re-election. Mark Ridley Thomas, convicted of corruption charges. I mean, the cast of characters just seems like it keeps changing.
Yeah, it's a really, I mean, you know, we stopped filming in 2020, and that's kind of the date stamp for the film in the sense that, you know, when we were in post, things kept changing. Like you said, you know, Mayor Garcetti termed out. Mark Ridley Thomas, that just happened last week, the corruption trial. Bonin, and, you know, he, I think, you know, had all of them absolutely hearts in the right places. But I think voters expected quicker results. And it's one of these things where I think politicians are going to live and die on this issue. It's one of the most important issues for Californians and for Los Angelinos in particular, housing and homelessness. So I'm encouraged that Mayor Bass has made, you know, this such a central part of her new administration. Dr. Felicia Adams-Kellum, who was the CEO of St. Joseph Center, who we've interviewed in the film, is now running LASHA. And they are two incredibly impressive women who I'm hopeful can start pointing the ship in the right direction. And again, it wasn't that Mayor Garcetti didn't prioritize it or Bonin as well, but I think you run into the buzzsaw of opposition in local communities and zip codes. So I hope this can become a nonpartisan issue and that we can prioritize housing, because there's such a disinvestment in affordable housing on both the federal, state, and local level. I think we almost need like a Marshall Plan for housing in this country and prioritizing that. And we need to be thinking long term and about the systemic issues that lead to this growing disparity and the overrepresentation of Black Americans, both in, you know, poverty and homelessness populations. So I'm encouraged and I'm hopeful, but, you know, I think people want to see results, and they've been slow in coming. So maybe this is the tipping point where some sort of new coalition can start pushing common sense solutions along together.
Colin K. Gray, director of the documentary Unzipped, An Autopsy of American Inequality, in limited release this week at the Lemley Monica over in Santa Monica on 2nd Street. Colin, thanks for coming on and talking with us today. We appreciate it.
It's been an absolute pleasure, Steve. Thank you so much. And I hope everyone can get involved in the issue. Let's raise the roof.
More now of Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. It's COVID protections end this month in LA. A lot of folks are worried about a coming wave of evictions. Well, across the county line in Buena Park, that city is trying to do something to prevent them. Let's head to OC. Recently, renters and activists made a big push for rent control with the city council, hoping to become just the second city in Orange County to adopt those protections. Here to talk with us about it is LA Times columnist Gustavo Arellano, who's an expert on all things OC. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
What's Buena Park doing here with their rent control push?
Well, what you're seeing actually is a countywide push by a group of young progressives that have been going from city to city over the past, really since the pandemic, and asking these councils, saying, look, like, Orange County is not the place of rich white suburbia anymore. It's increasingly working class and increasingly poor. So let's try to get these initiatives, or try to get either via ballot measure, or better yet, via council edict, let's get rent control. So Santana, this happened in Santana. They were the first ones in Orange County to do it. And so now this same group of activists is now in Buena Park. They've gone to Costa Mesa before, but it seems to be getting this idea of rent control seems to possibly be getting some traction within the Buena Park City Council.
So what's Santa Ana seen so far from their rent control?
I would say more than anything, peace of mind for renters. Santana is a very renter-heavy city. But also, whenever you're going to get rent control in California, you're going to get developers and landlords saying, this is communism. We don't want it. So Santana's also fighting right now a lawsuit by the Apartment Association of Orange County saying that what they have done with the rent control, in other words, capping how much landlords can raise the rents every year, but that policy on its face is illegal and unconstitutional and should be overturned. So I think that's what any city that's going to consider rent control in Orange County or even beyond Orange County always has to face that threat.
And what's been the reception if they've been going all across? I mean, you always talk about how Orange County is sort of two counties, right? You got South County, which is very different, right, from the northern part. I mean, Buena Park's right across the L.A. line. So is there a different feeling, or what kind of reception are they getting from across O.C.?
I mean, if they did this 10 years ago, these activists, they would be laughed out of almost every city council. But now the fact that you're getting a more receptive audience, that really says a lot about how Orange County has changed, even just in the past decade. And Buena Park's an interesting example because I knew it because, of course, Knott's Berry Farm. And back in the day for the old schoolers, the Buena Park Mall, it's literally down La Palma Avenue from Anaheim where I grew up. And I always saw it as sort of a slightly richer version of Anaheim. So, you know, suburban tract homes and all of that. But that's changed in the past 10 to 15 years. Now it's more Latino. It's far more Korean now than it was growing up. And more importantly, you have a city council where you have two young progressives, Connor Trout and Jose Trinidad Castañeda. They are flat out progressives. And so now they're pushing these proposals on a city council that's also, I believe it's majority Democrat, but maybe not the same type of Democrat that is necessarily open to progressive ideas.
You mentioned the developers and the landlords. I mean, they're almost always lamenting, right, about being limited in how much they can charge. I mean, who are the folks who are really pushing back?
Oh, it's always going to be developers, landlords, sometimes mom and pops. Like, and especially it's interesting in Buena Park because Jose Trinidad Castañeda, he knows this. So he says, I actually think that this cap should be lower. In other words, how much you could rent it per year. In California, you cannot go higher than 5% of a raise. He wants to do it for 3%, but he also wants to create some sort of panel involving developers and saying, look, you are not the enemy. Developers are not the enemy. Landlords are not the enemy. But if you want a living, viable city where residents are not going to be living in poverty or not faced with evictions because they cannot deal with a raise, then we need to talk about this. And that's what he feels. Of course, the other side says, no, landlords should be able to raise rents as much as possible. And especially, they always use the card of the mom and pop landlord, the 80-some-year-old or 70-some-year-old that owns another house, and that's how they're funding their retirement. But I would always love to see how many of those are around as opposed to bigger developers.
But the rent control, let's make it clear, the rent control, at least in Buena Park, would apply to housing that's 15 years old or older, right? It's not new developments.
Yeah, that's also been part of California law. They always try to limit how far rent control can go. I mean, in KCRW land out in Santa Monica, I know that's been something like that for a while. Like, you cannot keep putting rent control, especially on your houses, because the idea is that developers will not want to build new housing, which just exacerbates housing costs, rent prices, and, crowding in cities. So it'll be interesting with Buena Park. Costa Mesa has also considered that, but that hasn't gone anywhere. But again, I would not underestimate the willpower of these younger activists. Some of them, it's been great to see some of them. I remember them in high school, and now they're young adults, and they are totally trying to reimagine what Orange County can be. And especially with something as sacrosanct as housing prices and rent control, it's going to be interesting to see.
Gustavo Arellano, columnist for the LA Times and a regular, of course, here on GLA. Gustavo, thanks.
Gracias.
That's going to do it for us today. Tomorrow, there's a big push to transition away from gas-powered cars to electric ones. So what are the pros and the cons right now? Is this a good time to take the plunge? What about the credits? What about the range anxiety? That's all yours tomorrow on GLA. We are online anytime at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Drop us a line, share your thoughts with us, even share a story with us, maybe something you want to hear from your neighborhood. Tell us about it so we can tell the masses about it. And grab the podcast, too, all at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Juliana Mayo, Zeke Reed, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, Amy Talk, Carlos Ramirez, Christine Camito, and Christian Borda all helped with today's episode. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Have a great day.